This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
This is E.O. Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams, and you're listening to the
Humanist Network
Humanist
News.
Network
Humanist
News.
Network News.
The Humanist Network News.
I ain't afraid of your Yahweh. I ain't afraid of your Allah. I ain't afraid of your Jesus. I'm afraid of what you do in the name of your God.
It's June 27th, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the Institute for Humanist Studies. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. For those of you joining us for the first time, humanism is seeking without religion the best in and for human beings. So Jess, who do we have on our show today?
We have today, Duncan, a rabbi, a knight, and a lawyer driving cross-country in a VW Bug.
All right, wait a minute. I've heard this one before. I think I know how it goes. Now, what is this a joke or what?
The rabbi on the show is Sherwin Wine of the Society for Humanistic Judaism, and the knight is Salman Rushdie, the novelist who has appeared on the last two shows.
Sir Salman Rushdie now.
Sir, yes, correct. And the lawyer is Professor Alan Dershowitz from Harvard. He teaches law there. And the VW Bug comes in with Aaron Davies, a grad student at Russell Sage University, had sort of an incident with her VW Bug that she talks about.
Okay, so what's going on with Sir Salman Rushdie?
As many of our listeners know, Salman Rushdie is a novelist who also happens to be an atheist and a secular humanist, and he was awarded the Lifetime Achievement Award for Cultural Humanism at the New Humanism Conference in Harvard last April. And more recently, actually last week, Salman Rushdie was knighted by Queen Elizabeth for his services to literature. I wonder which was a bigger event for Rushdie. Anyway, this knighthood once again inflamed the same parts of the Muslim world that issued a fatwa against Rushdie, sentencing him to death 18 years ago after writing the satanic verses.
Yeah, it's got to definitely be a horrible form of deja vu that he's experiencing right now. And I believe he had to go into hiding for at least 5 years, if not more, the first time. So our thoughts are with Salman Rushdie. I've been flipping through the newspaper articles about the situation, and I was looking at a photograph the other day in the AP in Pakistan, and there were some students holding up signs. One student in the picture had a sign that said, "Queen Elizabeth, shame to you." Another said, "Rushdie is the evil." And the third one said, "Students are ready to kill." So this is sounding a lot like the Muslim riots over the Danish Muhammad cartoons that we've talked about before on the show.
Right. Our next segment features Alan Dershowitz, who has been called the best known criminal lawyer in the world and also the top lawyer of last resort. Dershowitz is known for defending clients such as O.J. Simpson, Mike Tyson, and former Deputy Prime Minister of Israel, Anatoly Sharansky. Dershowitz is also a best-selling author for both fiction and nonfiction. Some of his recent titles include The Case for Peace, How the Arab-Israel Conflict Can Be Resolved, and also Rights from Wrongs, a secular theory of the origins of rights. So Dershowitz is a professor of law at Harvard Law School, which is where Duncan grabbed sort of, he was on his coattails on the way out of a building, interviewed him on the steps, which is why you're going to hear...
You're going to hear the door slamming and people sort of saying, "Get out of the way," and stuff. So I apologize for the poor recording quality.
Secular. When did secular become a dirty word?
Well, there are a lot of dirty words these days. Liberal is a dirty word. Secular is a dirty word. Humanist is a dirty word. It's a very defensive attitude by mostly Christian fundamentalists, but others. Who fear competition in the marketplace of ideas and who are trying to demonize those of us who are human-centered and reason-centered. Faith has become a powerful, powerful word, and those of us on the secular side shouldn't demean other people's faith, and they shouldn't demean our reason. It's very important that we make the positive case for humanism and for human-centered morality.
Why is secular law the best way to promote human rights?
We live in a diverse world, and we're all human, and humanism is what unites us all, whereas religion divides us. And the United States is built on a high wall of separation between church and state. And so although in a democracy, everybody has the right to vote according to their own conscience, people of faith based on faith, people of reason based on reason, the government itself must be based on the separation issue. And the separation issue says that churches, religious institutions, may not determine American policy. American policy has to be determined based on human-centered considerations, and the churches should thrive. People should be free to go to them and have faith-based private organizations. But when the government is asked to spend all of our money and make all of our policy, it has to be done on the common denominator of humanism.
So that was my stairwell interview with Alan Dershowitz. These are the lengths that I go through to bring these people to you listeners.
I.e. stalking.
Stalking, reporting, whatever. There's a fine line. I was actually able to catch up with Alan Dershowitz after he talked to the Secular Student Alliance during their annual conference, which they happen to be holding at Harvard in conjunction with the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard. Professor Dershowitz had to follow Jess and me.
Which he was not happy about at all, folks.
It's very intimidating. he was also competing with lunch, so that's why we couldn't get a decent recording of what he said. But I thought it was great, especially when he just sort of burst in the room and was like, I am a secular humanist. Like, he was very excited. And
he also told a joke from a Woody Allen movie where, you know, Woody is an atheist Jew and his wife was a Catholic atheist, and the two were arguing about which God they were going to raise their children to not believe in.
That's a great segue for our next guest, Rabbi Sherwin Wein, founder of the international movement known as Humanistic Judaism. Rabbi Sherwin Wein was one of the speakers at the New Humanism Conference in April, and he joined Salman Rushdie in the panel discussion titled Toward an Abrahamic Humanism. In 2003, the American Humanist Association awarded Sherwin Wein with the Humanist of the Year. I interviewed Rabbi Sherwin Wein with Matt Sherry, Executive Director of the Institute for Humanist Studies at the New Humanism Conference in April. We're going to hear that interview in one moment, but first we're going to introduce the segment with a recording from the conference by the Yiddish Community Chorus of the Workman's Circle.
I am the founder of a movement which is now an international movement called Humanistic Judaism. I was born in Detroit, Michigan, into a Jewish family that had a nominal affiliation with the conservative synagogue. But basically, both my family and most of the Jews around me were fairly secular. They were members of the synagogue because that was the only way they could have a Jewish connection. But they were essentially not religious. And so that was my background. I had a very strong and intense Jewish cultural background. And from the very beginning, Judaism for me was not a religion. Judaism was a culture. And as I grew up, the idea of God was not important. Nobody talked about him. If anybody had a problem, they didn't call him. I mean, they went to see the doctor, they called the psychiatrist, whatever it was. It was a matter of indifference to religious help. They were secularized, as were most likely over half the population of the United States of America.
Do you mean the Jewish population or just the entire population?
Well, the Jewish population has the highest number of atheists of any ethnic or cultural group in the world.
Wow.
Somewhere around 20 to 25% of the Jewish population is atheist agnostic, and about 49 to 50%, if asked the question, are you secular or religious, will respond secular. So many of the people who are Jewish, who are members of religious organizations, are secular. They're members of that organization because there's no other way to be affiliated with the Jewish community. Mm-hmm. So that's the background for what I did. I went to the University of Michigan, already a humanist. I majored in philosophy, which only confirmed my humanism. When I graduated, I had to figure out my career. I could teach philosophy, and that was sort of boring to me. What I wanted was to work with people. I like to work with people. I like to organize. And I wanted to do something philosophical. So the closest thing I could find, since I also was very passionately interested in Jewish culture, I thought of the rabbinate. And the closest rabbinate was the Reform rabbinate. I told him exactly what I believed. He said, don't worry, many of us are also humanists. So, good. They went down there, and it was true. Close to 50% of the people who were in the student body were humanists. I would call them closet humanists, because when they went out into the field, they conformed to the official ideology of the movement. But I didn't, because life is too short to lose your integrity.
Why is there such a high rate of atheism among the Jewish people?
Well, there are two reasons. One, Jews took this to the secular revolution like ducks to water, because it was a way of coming out of persecution. They were never allowed to enter educational institutions before. Now, in a new secular world, they what? After the French Revolution, they were admitted. So having a strong tradition of literacy and study, they just took to secular education, and they were secularized. So they were well-educated, and they were secularized. And the second reason is anybody who looks at Jewish history would be crazy to say that Jewish history points to a wonderful, loving God running the world. After the Holocaust, you would have to be insane. So both because of their experience and the levels of their education, they have incredibly high levels of atheists. Sometimes you go to an atheist meeting and 50% of the people sitting around the table are Jews.
Right. Does a Jewish person approach humanism differently than, say, a Christian approaches humanism or a Muslim, which is part of what you were discussing today on the
panel?
Well,
the different approach is memory. Huh. WASPs, those are white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, mm-hmm. are people who have experienced power right. For most of their... Do you understand? The British sense of humor is the sense of humor of a powerful people. Mm-hmm. That's what British humor is. All right. So WASPs approach humanism differently because they're not quite sure they want to be bossed by God anyway. So, I mean... But Jews approach it from their experience. And their experience is that their culture was taken over by the clergy for hundreds and hundreds of years, and the clergy kept telling them that they were the chosen of God and were being protected. Only they were what? Getting hit over the head all the time. So what that produces is something called skepticism. So Jewish humor is a kind of skeptical. It's based on experience and memories. And Jews recognize that. That's one of the recognizable things in other Jews, is this the skepticism. And that's what made Jews very good in the world of science. Because to be good in the world of science, you have to, what, challenge everything. And that was the thing about Jews, as I was growing up, that they did forever and ever. That's why when there were two in one room, they got, what, five political parties, right? So
what's happening currently with the humanistic
Judaism? Well, humanistic Judaism started with one congregation, mine, in 1969, because we got some really very good national, international publicity. Lots of people contacted us and wanted to organize congregations just like our own communities. So we went out and did that, and we created in 1969 the Society for Humanistic Judaism, which is the national organization. And then in 1986, having made contact with Israel and Europe, we organized the International Federation of Secular Humanistic Jews and simultaneously established a school for training leaders. So we have two levels of leadership, rabbi, which means teacher, and para-rabbi, which is for small communities that can't afford a full-time rabbi, and we continue to expand. We just ordained, for the first time, seven rabbis in Israel, and we have a class of 30, actually, there, and it's really getting off the ground. It's very important. The two main centers of Jewish population in the world are Israel and North America. So Israel has close to 6 million, and North America has 6 million. That's 12 million. That leaves only about 1.5 million for the rest of the world. So those are the two main communities. We're moving forward, and the key to our success is that we train more and more leaders. And in fact, we've given one leader to the general humanist world. He is the humanist chaplain at Harvard. His name is Greg Epstein.
How are humanist rabbis, how is your movement received by other Orthodox Jews?
Well, I mean, the reception is twofold. There are those people who are very enthusiastic we exist. Either they're enthusiastic because they believe what we're saying, or two, they realize that we reach a portion of the Jewish population that conventional denominations can't reach. Then there's that group, Orthodox, they can be Reformed, Conservative, doesn't make any difference, who are overwhelmingly hostile to us. And then there's this in-between group. It's called the neither here nor there. That is part of, and that's what where most people are in life. It's neither here nor there. So these people, one day they say, you do something and they, oh, it's wonderful. And the next day, but they don't believe in God. So it's back and forth. Increasingly, the enthusiasts have been growing. The hostile group has been shrinking, and the ambivalent group has been shrinking. So we're getting, we're an accepted part of the Jewish community in most places. The Jewish community now has such diversity that the leaders of Jewish federations in most cities are very happy to have anybody who shows up and wants to be part of the Jewish community. We are bringing Jews into the Jewish world, as we're bringing humanists into the organized humanistic world, since we're part of both worlds.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe to me some of the rituals or ceremonies or events that a humanist rabbi might conduct?
Right. All right. First, let me do life cycle. Mm-hmm. So there is birthing. A child is born. Now you want a celebration. Jews historically did circumcision. I always found it rather bizarre. The only thing they could think of for the ceremony was surgery. I just never, is there something else you could do? I mean, we don't do circumcision. If people choose to have it done, then they can have it done by an obstetrician in the hospital. What we do, a ceremony that fits both boys and girls, is we have a ceremony where the child is welcomed into the Jewish people and welcomed into humanity, right? Simultaneously, the human community. And the sign of that is the child receives a name. There's the name the child most likely will use in an English-speaking environment. And then the child receives a Hebrew name as a sign of his or her membership in the Jewish community. Then we have a puberty rite, which is called bar or bat mitzvah. And what the child does is, conventionally you read from the Bible. For us, that's very limiting. the most important literature for us, the Jews, have created, that's humanistic, is in the last 300 years. So our young people choose a Jewish hero. The hero can be Sigmund Freud, Albert Einstein. Do you understand? There are all these people. Mm-hmm. And then they do research on the life of the person, and then they present the story of the person, and then relate that story to their own personal life. So the person serves as a role model. All right. And then, of course, we have weddings, and then we have, unfortunately, the funerals. Then there's the second thing. If we're talking about ceremonial work, there are the holidays. So the holidays go back before the priests and rabbis figured out monotheism. I mean, they go back to polytheistic times. So there's spring holidays, fall holidays. So we have a spring holiday called Passover, right? Do we believe the Exodus took place? Most likely, no. However, is that experience not a Jewish experience? Well, my parents were part of an Exodus, the most incredible Exodus of Jews in the history of the Jewish people, from Europe to North America, or from Europe and North America to Israel. I mean, they're two. So what we do is we try to tell stories that are real as opposed to stories that are mythical. And we celebrate liberation, right, and freedom. So each holiday has a kind of moral message. Passover has freedom. Chanukah has courage. And then we have Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which are considered to be the major days of reflection, and that's self-reflection. And the value there is something called rationality, which most people fail to use in their life.
Do you approach the scripture as literature? I mean, do you still incorporate the scripture?
The scripture is, for us, the Bible is the beginning of Jewish literature. The Bible is Jewish literature, right? In the way Beowulf is English literature, so it's Jewish literature. Mm-hmm. Our approach to the Bible is to treat it as literature. Parts of the Bible, the Bible consists of narrative, laws, poetry, whatever. Most of the laws are outdated or morally questionable. The narratives are sometimes true, sometimes doctored, and sometimes absolutely false, but they are a clue to what really happened. So the Bible is a good clue to the early history of the Jews. And some of the poetry is quite magnificent. There are pieces in the Bible that are quite wonderful. So we're selective. Mm-hmm. We use the parts that are most important, and our principle is the things written a long time ago are not superior because they were written a long time ago. There may be somebody who wrote something yesterday, do you understand, who has written something fantastic. Mm-hmm. So we would use that. We don't have to feel compelled to always use the past literature.
Yeah.
That was another selection by the Yiddish Community Chorus of the Workman's Circle, courtesy of the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard. But before that, we were listening to an interview by Matt Cherry and Duncan Crary with Rabbi Sherman Wein, who serves as a founding rabbi of the Birmingham Temple. He also maintains his involvement with the Society of Humanistic Judaism by traveling to communities and serving the needs of humanistic Jews.
To learn more about the Society for Humanistic Judaism, visit shj.org. So, Jess, I understand we have a listener comment this month.
That's right. Martin White from Salem, New York, writes in, I'd like to use this forum to give some reaction to the podcast, of which I am a faithful listener and fan. First, I noted that Duncan Crary referenced E.O. Wilson's past of being charged with racism, though the Conley professor did not give any notice to it. The tag is a highly charged one, not one to be casually referenced, and one that I would never mention without giving the alleged perpetrator the chance to respond. I believe through recent reading in that history and the Academy has absolved the fine man of that charge. That said, I do want to defend another great man, Richard Dawkins, against Mr. Wilson's description of him as leading the military wing of the humanist movement. That word, too, in this age of Anglo-American military imperium of earth-shattering lethality, is wrong on its face. Mr. Dawkins advocates against sectarian violence and then is branded a fundamentalist for having the temerity to be fed up publicly with all the religious claptrap that has infested our human civilization. Lastly, could you explain the process that has awarded a humanist album of the year to a neo-folky God believer? Duncan did pose very gently the nature of the problem to Dar Williams, but I could only shake my head at the absurdity of the situation. The last thing the secular humanist movement needs is more fuddy-duddyism, and boy, did I hear all of that at Greg Epstein's New Humanism Summit. The strumming and wailing from either Miss Williams or the Secular Turks should have cleared the room.
Ouch. If you'd like to leave us a listener comment, you can email us like Martin did at editor@humaniststudies.org, and we'll read your comment on the air. But you can also leave us an audio comment on the H&N listener comment line by calling 206-339-4168.
Another thing you can do on our audio listener comment line is leave a question for Sweet Reason, the humanist advice columnist.
We're going to be running another Sweet Reason audio Sweet Reason installment soon, so try to get your questions in soon.
As some of our listeners might know, Duncan, June is known as the Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgendered Pride Month. And you and I were marching with Empire Pride Alliance in our Capital District Pride Fest. Mm-hmm. And also marching in that was Aaron Davies and Fagbug.
Why don't I read a little section from Aaron Davies' website, fagbug.com. And the question posed there is, what is Fagbug? On the 11th Annual National Day of Silence, April 18, 2007, Aaron Davies was faced with an unfortunate tragedy. She was the victim to a hate crime. Because of sporting a rainbow sticker on her VW Beetle, her car was vandalized in red spray paint with the words FAG and You Are Gay placed all over the hood and the driver's side of her car. Despite immediate shock and embarrassment, she decided to embrace what happened and keep driving her car as it is in order to increase public awareness about the blatant homophobia that exists in our society.
And Aaron is doing this. She's actually driving her fag bug on a cross-country trip, and she's going to take it to as many diverse locations as possible. Mm-hmm. She's going to gather feedback so that she can make a documentary, which will shed light on the intolerance that exists, you know, all over the country. Mm-hmm. Aaron's goal is to get at least 1 million people to add fag bug rainbow stickers to their cars so that no one else is ever targeted like she was. So until that happens, she's going to keep the spray paint on her car.
Right.
As is.
Jess interviewed Aaron Davies yesterday at the Humanist Center in downtown Albany.
Aaron Davies, thanks for coming down to our Humanist Center in downtown Albany. Tell us a little bit about, give us some background here for Fagbug.
Okay. Basically, on April 18th, my car was vandalized in Albany. I was just parked at my home outside on the street, and someone, during the middle of the night between like, you know, 9 p.m. and then 10:30 in the morning, someone spray painted on my car the words fag and you are gay. They spray painted fag on my driver's side window, like all across the window. And then you are gay is like all over my hood. I think it happened because I had like a long skinny rainbow sticker on the back of my car. Mm-hmm. You know, and the police, like I called the police, did a police report, and you know, they didn't really think it was like a hate crime. Like they first took the angle of like, well, who are your enemies and that kind of thing. But eventually, after talking to them several times, they do acknowledge that it is a hate crime. You know, like a random act, you're just kind of inspired by the sticker or lashing out by that.
The words "you are gay" is a hate crime against.
Yeah, and also writing "fag" like it's a more derogatory term used towards a guy. So I think whoever did it assumed for whatever reason that it was a man's car. So based on the words they wrote, you know, at first I thought maybe it's personal. Like when I very first saw it, I was like shocked, you know, and it is my car. So it was like personally like my vehicle. So, but after like, you know, a couple of seconds of just reading it and then letting it sink in, I just realized like it was because of my sticker. After just like starting to talk more to people about it, I realized like how much of a difference like a perspective people had on it. Just even that idea of like, should I keep a sticker on or not? And the more people I talked to, the more I realized this is like an important decision, not just for myself, but for the community as a whole, you know. Like I think if I took it my sticker off, then I think a lot of people, like even just my immediate friends, and then like a bigger message that it would send out to other people is that you know just to let people like make you feel afraid and intimidated, and like that you can't just be yourself, you know. And so by keeping it on, I think it's saying something stronger. Like even for me to keep it on, it's like even though this happened to my car, I still have decided to, like, you know, I'm not going to change anything about my choices or what I did just based on someone's ignorance or intolerance.
Over the next couple of days, Erin began to notice a dialogue happening in her community.
So I drove the rental car for 2 days, and all these people in my neighborhood, because my car was parked there, because I had to wait, you know, just by default, mm-hmm. like I had to wait for the insurance to come and look at it. So many people in my neighborhood came up to me while driving the rental car, just like outraged by seeing my car, and like stopping me in the middle of traffic to like have to like talk to me about it and have a dialogue. And then, so I don't know, after like those 2 days, like even though I was trying to like distance myself from it and like remove myself from the whole thing by not driving the car, it just kept like coming to me like over and over again, like even when I was away from it. So I just felt like there was something there that, you know, it's very strong just by it being even parked.
The next day she drove her car to school in downtown Troy, Erin happened to find a very public parking spot outside of her admissions building. And just like at home with her community, Erin's school also had a very strong and diverse opinion about seeing her car with the vandalism shown.
Basically, within 1 hour of my car being parked on campus, there were like 50 phone calls made to public safety, and people were like outraged and responding. And it sort of reiterated my feeling that there's like two polar opposite responses that, you know, that I was getting, and that dialogue that I was creating with people just by having it be parked somewhere. Right. So, you know, wherever I take it, people just assume that it just happened. And so people were like in a frenzy. I guess their office was just flooded and like this panic, and they didn't know if it just happened there. And like, what did they do? And people either wanted it removed immediately, or they just wanted to like help, you know, or they were empathetic to my situation.
In addition to the dialogue that was happening all around Erin, she began getting notes on her windshield, again, with polar opposite responses. Eventually, with the help and encouragement of a friend, Erin decided to make the best out of the situation by leaving the spray paint on her car and driving it across country. Her friend dubbed it "Fag Bug," activism on wheels.
At first, it was just like this experiment to drive it for a week. I was like, I don't even think I can do that at first, you know. So I was just going to try to test it out and like raise some awareness and maybe drive my car around for 7 days, you know.
Right.
So you know what I mean, I wasn't really expecting this. Not like it happened, I was like, oh, let me start a campaign, this is great, you know. Like, right. I was like any normal person, just like humiliated by the whole thing, and I didn't really want to have anything to do with it, but it just kept coming to me. And even with my friend buying the website, it was like just that happening again. Like, you know, he started the whole MySpace, you know. Once I just typed in on MySpace, like, you know, this is what happened, this is what I'm doing, decided to embrace it. And once I announced, like, making my own stickers, you know, rather than take mine off, like, adding more to my car and making my own, like, Fagbug stickers, I really want to target the stickers to, like, people that are gay and straight. So, like, my whole thing is all about people, like, outside the gay community, too, like, coming together so we don't have this kind of thing happening anymore. Right. Like, no, just so no one could be targeted again for, like, if everybody on the block had, like, a rainbow sticker on the car. Like, it would be really hard for somebody like target who's gay and who's not gay. And right. So like, you couldn't have enough spray paint to like go around and like cover everyone's car, you know? So that's kind of the concept with the stickers. Just like, you know, as somebody that did have like a hate crime like happen to them, like, I'm just going to like stand up against it and do something like really like bold with it, you know? And 45 out of 55 days, I'm going to be confronting the general public with my car and, you know, right. trying to talk to people who aren't tolerant. And I think that's a pretty... you know, risky thing to do. So, Absolutely. So I'm really, the goal of the whole trip is to, you know, definitely have that dialogue with people that aren't as accepting and to kind of give a face to it. And, you know, I think that a lot of people aren't really connected to, maybe they don't know anyone that's gay, maybe for whatever reason, they're, it's not important to them, like, doesn't relate to them. So even when people, like high school students, when they say, oh, you know, that's so gay, or like fag, right, or they just use this language, they don't realize who it's like ripping down because it's not connected to them. They just say it so loosely, they're right, not really, maybe they don't even mean to, like, they just don't probably even realize what they're, you know, the implications of what they're saying and how that could impact someone else that's sitting right next to them.
Right.
Basically, I'm doing some speaking events, or just I'm doing like 10 gay prides, okay, or like mm-hmm. 10 gay event related mm-hmm. events, to like sell like my t-shirts and stickers to like help raise money for the trip. And also, I mean, so like if I don't get a speaking event in a certain place, like I'll just be taking, I'm going to do something really touristy in each area. So like, you know, just like in Topeka, Kansas, that's where like Brown versus the Board of Education took mm-hmm. place, and they have like a museum there. So like, or just other places like in Arkansas, like I'm not doing a speaking event there. I'm just going to do like this spontaneous event of going to Walmart. It's like the very first Walmart that was ever made. And, you know, how general public is people that go to Walmart? I mean, you know, right. so I basically like it, since it's the very first, like, you know, Walmart that was ever made, I'm going to take my car there. And, you know, I'll probably like go in and maybe like shop or something, mm-hmm. you know, just like pretend that I'm just like anyone else going there, and then come out and, you know, just, I don't know, or just observe the response that it gets just by being, you know, in the park. Maybe I'll go there early in the morning and have this great parking spot there. So right. everybody's going to see it that comes in and out and just kind of watch it and, you know, maybe talk to people about it.
You know, in the humanist community, we recognize that a lot of opposition to homosexuality or to gay marriage comes from some sort of religious reading the Bible or teaching. In your experience, was your opposition from just people, you know, with sort of a public standpoint, or was it more of a religious opposition to it?
I don't know. I've seen it a lot since I've come out about the whole fag book thing. I haven't really personally like had that response yet, but I'm sure in the cross country trip, like I'm going to all variety of places, so I'm sure right. that I'm gonna like receive that on the trip
as a comeback. If someone tells you God hates fags, you can tell them God also hates shrimp, because in the Bible, in the book of Leviticus, you know, the passage is you're not allowed to shave your beard if you're a man, or lie with another man, or eat shellfish. Like right. it's all like in the same, you know, breath right. in the Bible. So
yeah, like there's a pastor that I used to work with in Baltimore, and he like went to schools and kind of like broke down the Bible like that, like certain things of that time, like that made sense then that we don't apply now. But why right. is it that we have like, you know, this selection of things that just were allowed to apply still like that, like, you know, right. What's wrong with eating shrimp? Like, we do it all the time, you know.
Exactly.
So I think it's just people's way of justifying, like, you know, what they want to like support and what they don't want to support. But right. if that's the case, then yeah, those rules from way back then, we should apply all of them if we're going to apply one or the other,
right.
you know.
Yeah, you can't pick and choose based on your own sort of comfort level.
Yep. And I've also heard about that website, God Hates Fags.
Yes.
Like Fred Phelps, like I didn't really know much about him before this whole thing happened, but so I like, I'm part of the trip, I'm going to go to like Topeka, Kansas. I was going to like directly like confront, you know, him or go to his church, but some people think it's like too scary or unsafe for me to do that. So I'm going to be there, and I like, just for my own self, I want to like learn more about him and what he does. And, you know, he's obviously pretty extremist. So kind of confronting fag bug with God hates fags is, you know,
right.
An interesting contradiction.
Right.
So, but I don't know, it's interesting to me that people are just so like close-minded in how they use religion to kind of allow that and justify it.
So what can our humanist listeners do to help you or support you?
Well, through the website, just fagbug.com. I'm selling just fagbug rainbow stickers for people's cars, and I'm selling t-shirts too. So just little ways to help would just be like buy a sticker or buy a t-shirt. And I also have like a donate button. You can donate through PayPal to just help out with like gas or hotel expenses. That's the main thing, you know, just kind of like help out with just getting a sticker or a shirt. And
or can they come to one of your events?
Yeah, just sort of check out the website. I have like my itinerary there, and as I go, like I'll be getting all the details on too. So just mm-hmm. you can come to an event or send me an email, and get the more support that I get, the, you know, I think those types of emails that I get that are supportive are kind of like fueling me to keep going with the whole thing, because like I said, I've gotten a lot of like adverse responses just with the whole experience, and sometimes it can be hard, but the more like, you know, once, you know, I'll just get like an email, this is encouraging me, and it's like, wow, this is why I'm doing it. So I have to keep going, even though it's hard. So,
right. Well, thank you so much for doing what you're doing, Aaron. And
thanks
for coming to speak with us.
That was Jess Constantine speaking with Aaron Davies yesterday. Aaron Davies is heading a project which she calls fagbug.com, and she's bringing her VW Beetle, which was vandalized with homophobic slurs, across country to a town maybe near you. So if you want to learn more about Aaron Davies and her project, visit fagbug.com. One of the reasons why we wanted to include this segment was, number one, it's Pride Month. But also that, you know, humanists and all people need to be concerned about prejudice and discrimination
of
and
any
homophobia.
Kind. Right.
Right. I really like this project because it's uncomfortable to be faced with discrimination. Like, even if you don't discriminate against people, even if you don't say homophobic things, even if you don't say racial things, you know, it still
happens around you. It's still something that you have to confront, whether it's in yourself or in someone else. And it's just as uncomfortable, you know, regardless of where it happens.
And sometimes you're just as obligated to speak out against someone else. I mean, sometimes it's not enough to just not say something homophobic. Maybe you need to actually step up and say, hey, that's not acceptable.
Absolutely.
And stand up for someone else.
And I like that Erin is including, she's trying to sort of bridge this alliance between, you know, homosexuals, but also heterosexuals, because if everyone has a fag bug rainbow sticker on their car, then whoever is thinking about maybe vandalizing it is not going to know if the person is actually homosexual or heterosexual.
Right.
So it's kind of a nice alliance building.
Because we're all people. We're all humans.
That's right.
Well, they're just to wrap it up, Erin told us that the police are looking into this incident and they have some leads as to who might have actually perpetrated the crime.
That's right. And if you'd like to help Erin make her journey across country, visit her website, fagbug.com, or visit her MySpace page to see where she'll be stopping at myspace.com/fagbug.
I know one thing that would really help out Erin is if she's going to be stopping in your town, if you could contact the local newspaper or the local TV station for her, let them know that she is going to be in town. That might help get some media coverage for this event.
Also, as we've mentioned, Erin is a grad student and she's an artist, neither of which lend, you know, wealth to an individual. Mm-hmm. So Erin's, you know, she's funding this trip herself or with funds that she raises by selling her fag bug stickers and t-shirts and other fag bug merchandise. But, you know, definitely she needs your support. So you can donate to her using PayPal from her website, fagbug.com. It's a great cause.
Well, that's it for our show this month. To leave a listener comment, dial 206-339-4168, or you can send us a comment by email at editor@humaniststudies.org.
To read show notes or transcripts of our podcast, visit humaniststudies.org/podcast.
You can also listen to previous episodes of the podcast there. If you have not subscribed to our show using our RSS feed, which we highly recommend, on the off weeks when we're not producing the podcast, we're actually on something else. We're putting out the H&N e-zine, which you can read at humaniststudies.org.
Our theme music was generously provided by Holly Near. You can get more information at hollynear.com.
I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.